I moved up and down, you know, in between senior roles. I had built up a really strong community, but it was time for me to figure out what I could do without being British or BBC journalist. I wanted to know what else I was. And the thing is, when you're in an institution, it's very easy to become institutionalized. And having done a lot of those stories, so they did have an effect on me, I felt that I needed to find a little bit more about my own identity. So that's what happened in 2021. The fact there was a cost of living crisis, would I have thought differently about it? I would have factored that in further, I think, because working as a freelancer is not necessarily easy.
Our guest is Druti Shah, a journalist who spent nearly 14 years with BBC News across various editorial roles before pivoting her career in 2021. She has since written books, started doing public speaking and event moderation. Plus, she is even a coach and she does consultancy work. Welcome, Druti. It's really a pleasure to have you here on When Power Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really looking forward to our conversation.
As I like to start with all my guests on this podcast, I like you to look back at the moment you decided you wanted to become a journalist.
That's many, many years ago. So I would have been about 8 years old. And I just realized that I really loved telling stories and I wanted to tell people about what was going on in the world. And there were two sort of key moments. One was there's a program that's still running at the moment called Newsround on the BBC, which was all about encouraging child journalists. So having seen other children be able to tell stories, it really was an inspiring moment. And then another moment was when a boy at my school fell into the canal. And, you know, my first instinct was, we've got to tell people, oh my gosh, what's in the canal? So this, like, you know, sort of dirty water, as it were. Will he be all right? Are there diseases? What's going to go on? And that's when I realized, that's probably not a normal reaction to somebody falling in the canal. So wanting to tell people and report what's going on is really, really important. And that's what made me think maybe journalism is a vocation that I'm going to be following.
Did you have any role models, any journalists that maybe you look up to it, or any particular even author or books that, you know, inspire you?
When I was younger, if I'm honest with you, there weren't a lot of people who looked like me who were in journalism. So if you really wanted to know who my role models were, and this is probably a little bit surprising, two things. One is Clark Kent from Superman, because he was a journalist. Oh, well, him and Lois Lane, actually. So reading comics was really, really important to me. And another one was a book series I read when I was younger called Sweet Valley High. And again, there was a character, a twin there called Elizabeth Wakefield, who was nothing like me whatsoever, you know, white, American, Californian. But he was involved in journalism. And so I think when you have access to books, especially that inspire you, it really can make a difference. So for me, that set me on the path. And then the older I got, the more I came across individuals that were doing amazing stories or were just telling people what was going on in the world. And I thought, actually, I can do this. This is something for somebody like me. So yes, books and comics.
Well, that's some interesting role models there. And you say something really interesting, which is that you couldn't see anyone that looked like you on the news. And we're going to circle back to this later on in the interview. I have a curiosity. Do you remember the first story that you covered as a professional journalist?
This is a long time ago. Actually, this is quite important to my career in that I try to get work experience. When you don't know anybody who's in the industry, it's actually very, very difficult, because journalism is actually a lot about connections. It shouldn't be, but it is. And, you know, when you're a teenager and you're trying to be a journalist and you don't know anybody, it's really hard to get work experience. And actually, there was a woman called Barbara Fisher who ran the school pages at the Uxbridge Gazette. And I wrote to her and she gave me a chance. She was the first person who ever gave me a chance. And so going back to that sort of first piece I ever wrote, thank you, Barbara Fisher, because thanks to her, I got work experience and I was able to write pieces for the school's page. But I also managed to write, and at that time, it was quite mandatory in local papers that you would cover what was going on in the community. So the first story was about a garden centre opening, I'm pretty sure. I have it in my scrapbook still. I have an old scrapbook that I put together and it's covered with old newspapers. And it's got every single piece that I ever wrote as a kid, that I ever wrote as a kid. So from opening up garden centres and writing up notes about people's weddings to then doing international news, I pretty much covered every story that you could ever have in a news environment.
This is again really interesting. I was reading about you to prepare for this interview, and one thing that really impressed me is the variety of topics that you covered, and that you had the possibility to experiment through different, way of communicating. What is the most important skills that you have developed from this?
I am really lucky, and I feel that I'm quite privileged in that I've not necessarily been pigeonholed into doing certain things, and that the stories that I've had the breadth to cover have encompassed, as I say, everything. But in terms of that takeaway, if I'm honest with you, and I think this stands for any story that you can ever do, and any story that I ever write or create, I will always get a notepad and I will always write physically. Who, what, why, when, where, how. And making sure that those basics are covered. And from there, you honestly can build the most beautiful relationships with the audience by covering those basics, because that's what they're there for. It's like, well, why am I doing this story? What's it about? And that also means that the journalism that anybody can do, I don't actually think myself as anything special. It means that it engages. So you could be writing about, I don't know, something that's appeared on Reddit. But what will lift it is if you then go back to those basics and think, well, why is it so important that it's journalistically important? It's not just a piece of content that stays on one platform. In fact, it's important because it represents this about the world. So, for example, if I take one of the best stories I've ever had in my life, the privilege to cover was a story that did emerge on Reddit, which ended up becoming a trilogy for the BBC, where I was then at. And it was an anonymous piece, and somebody just put, funny little story, saying, "Oh, I've been texting my dead brother and his phone number, and actually somebody's now responded." And that story was very popular on Reddit, but it was anonymous. But what made it a piece of journalism, and I was very lucky to have the privilege that the people involved trusted me, is that I approached them, they Googled me, so a lot of Googling around, and they felt comfortable enough with me to write a story about friendship and about how you create friendship in a digital world when perhaps, for example, you have strangers. So I was very lucky in that these people allowed me to embark on their friendship with them as they, spoke to each other for the first time because they'd never spoken to each other, and as they also met in real life for the first time. And that came from something that a lot of other papers covered. As, oh, look at this funny thing on Reddit, to actually hear some journalism because this shows what it means to be human.
True. And what does how would you define a good story? What does it make a good story for you?
A good story is something that makes you think differently. I think that would be the key thing that I would say. You go away and you actually want to go and tell somebody else, hey, hold on a minute, did you know this? I've just read this, or I've just listened to this, particular podcast, and this is my takeaway. And that's what I think really good reporting and good journalism is about. That it's different to, for example, Vox Pops, where you just ask someone their opinion on something, and then it's put out there. And it provides significant context that someone's able to go away, and it's a primer for them. It shouldn't be the be all and end all. It should be for them to be like, oh wow, my neurons are now shifting. So I'm going to go and find out more about something. And for me, that is what makes a really good story.
I totally agree with this. I think a good story lives even when you close the newspaper or you switch off the radio and the TV, and you are able to put a seed of curiosity in the audience mind. So that's when you know that you actually score a good story and there is something worth for you to write about. Journalism is not an easy field to navigate. You mentioned that before as well, that is a place where you need a lot of connection to progress, and is a field as well that when it comes to women can have a lot of challenges. There was any challenge you had to face growing up as a journalist? If yes, how did you overcame those, and what would you recommend to a younger journalist that maybe today is facing the same difficulties?
As a journalist, you have to really be shameless, in that you can't be shy. I was actually quite a shy kid. You wouldn't think it, but I'm actually quite a shy person, but I had to build up that confidence to be like, well, actually, if I want to find out these stories, I need to speak to people. If I need to speak to people, then I've got to have the confidence to be able to speak to people in order to be able to then report what they're doing. So as a journalist, you have to be able to pick up the phone, not just rely on something that you found on the internet. You have to try and verify where did this actually come from. I'm very, very big on trying to get this due diligence and verification. And that's what I try and say to any like mentees or any other journalists that come to me. That's really important. In terms of, you also have to build up support networks as well. So they're going back to that element of connections. Again, that is often how a lot of work comes up or how you can get sponsored. So your name gets put on the table for work, for opportunities, for being the person that's really good fit for telling this story compared to others that perhaps are more conventional or more traditional. So that element of not just helping others take ownership of their voice, but also being able to take ownership of your own voice. I think that's really, really important for journalists as well. You can be impartial. So again, I come from a training where due impartiality is incredibly important, but at the same time, that doesn't mean that you can't have a voice of your own.
You mentioned two words, mentee and sponsorships, and you take me to my next question. Sponsorship and mentorship are two very different, but at the same time, quite similar things. What's your take on this, and what's also your experience? Because I know that you are working as a mentor, and you have a mentor yourself. But also, when it comes to journalism, sponsorship is again a very big important card to play. So, what do you think about it?
So I've split that up in terms of, yes, they are two very different things, but there is overlap. You're correct in that. So with mentoring, I've been very fortunate in that I try and bring in mentors in all parts of my life. So they don't necessarily have to be journalists, because with mentoring, you're learning from other people's experiences. And that journey is really, really important. And you can be reverse mentored. So you can learn from people who are perhaps younger than you or have like a completely polar opposite experience to you, but you will again find overlaps in terms of, oh, I'm in a difficult situation. I'm working with people who perhaps don't want to help me progress. So you can go to a mentor and ask them about things like that. What did you do when you were having trouble progressing? And again, for me, I think mentoring is really, really important to the fact that, I've been involved with the John Scofield Trust, which is a small charity, and it's a mentoring charity for quite a long time, because I think it's important to be able to try and give back. So I started off as a mentee from their scheme, and now I'm on the board as a trustee. So you can see for me that element of mentoring, especially for people who are from underrepresented groups, is really, really important. But what's just as important is sponsoring. Now, sponsoring is about putting other people's names on the table, especially when they're not there. So sponsoring is about saying, do you know what? Actually, I'm not necessarily the best person for this, but I'll tell you who is the best person for this. It's so and so. And that to me is an example of sponsoring. Or, oh, we need to try and do this particular project, but who can we get on board? Okay, here are the names that we should be looking forward. And often, going back to that element of connections, often sponsorship is happening, but not necessarily within the underrepresented communities. And that's where it's difficult, because they don't have those connections for somebody to put their name forward to say, oh, by the way, I know, so I know so and so, and those they should be the one who's good. Instead, you're relying on things like biases through putting in cold applications, or when people don't have that emotional connection with you, because that is what does make a difference. So sponsorship is very different, because it doesn't necessarily rely on the sponsors' experiences. It relies on professional credibility. It relies on it does rely on trust, but it also relies on saying, look, I know this person is somebody that's worth you at least looking at. Mentoring is about, here's what happened to me, perhaps, and perhaps my experiences are helpful for you to navigate your own path as well. And I think often there's a lot of emphasis on mentoring and less emphasis on sponsorship, again, for those from underrepresented backgrounds in the journalism world.
Maybe another part of the equation should be allyship then, to go together with sponsorships, especially.
Yeah, allyship is also incredibly important. But at the same time, and I've been having a lot of conversations actually. It's interesting you bring this up because I haven't quite fully articulated this, so this could be a first. Allyship is important, but at the same time, allyship has to understand that those who are allies are often in positions of privilege. So how can you bring people up without making them projects when it comes to allyship? And I'm not meaning that to, I'm hoping that doesn't sound rude or anything, but I do think sometimes there can be tendencies where people think they're doing a good thing, but they have to make sure that, you know, do respect the people that you're working with as an ally.
Interesting. It doesn't sound, it doesn't sound rude at all. Actually, it makes really sense, because if you think about it, even when you look at diversity and inclusion, sometimes is just an exercise of ticking the box and, you know, and okay, we need to be more diverse, so we're going to hire this and these people, and, you know, we just do it because this is what they are telling us to do. But then is the effort that you put into it that has to be genuine, and it's not just, you know, I'm doing it because they're telling me to do, because obviously then the effect will be completely different.
But exactly, and I want to pick up on that, because in those situations, when it becomes more of a lip service thing, like, oh no, we haven't got enough women, or we haven't got enough people from ethnic minorities, or we haven't got enough people from this particular intersectional background, where there's a challenge is you also have to make sure that you're not setting those people up to fail. By putting somebody in and then also not giving them the additional support network or support that they require, because bearing in mind, they're probably already at a disadvantage going way, way back. If they're then put into a position and they haven't been given that, you know, that box, that step up in order to be able to put them on a par with people who've already had the early start, etc., what you're actually potentially doing is creating a situation where you're going to end up losing them when you really want them in this industry. And that is, I think that is a reality. It's sad, but it is a reality, especially if we're talking about things like diversity and inclusion and equity, especially. There needs to be more emphasis on equity.
I totally agree with that. Even when it comes to gender equality policies, the fact that you write a policy, but maybe you don't apply, or then you don't offer the tools to your employees to make sure that this policy actually becomes a reality, then you're doing just half of the job, and, you know, you're setting everything up for failure rather than just making any step forward. So I really agree with what you say right now. So we're gonna discover what happened and why you decided to pivot your career and to go from being full-time employed and then, you know, exploring the world of being a freelancer, which is obviously quite different. But before we do that, you remember at the beginning you mentioned something related to the fact that you couldn't see journalists that look and sound like you when you were a younger. And I guess you spend 15 years now almost in the news industry, and things have changed, I hope. So compared to when you started and now, how do you see representation actually in media that has changed, or maybe hasn't changed?
So I used to work in local newspapers before I went to the BBC, and then since then I've been acting as freelance. Representation has definitely got better. I'm not going to take that away. There is still a long, long way to go. There's also challenges in the fact that you definitely get more people at the more entry level positions, and there's definitely lots and lots of schemes available in order to encourage people who are from these underrepresented backgrounds, you know, including women, including Muslim heritage, including LGBTQT plus backgrounds. However, where there still remains a significant issue, and I faced it myself, is that you can enter the profession, you can work in the profession. However, glass ceilings, issues around equal pay, issues around fair pay, gender equality still exist. And that's very, very disappointing. in that it's leading to challenges around retention and challenges around experience, and highly experienced journalists getting to a point where they're burnt out, where they're tired of fighting politics, you know, when sometimes they just want to tell the stories, and in fact are having to factor in additional emotional labor. So on one hand, representation is getting better, I think, at certain levels, but you still have issues where people in senior leadership positions are still from far more conventional, traditional backgrounds. And so there needs to be more emphasis on those pipelines.
We had the same conversation with Luba Kasova in the first episode of this series. We actually discussed the fact that, there are a lot of women, because obviously we look more at gender equality and diversity in that sense. A lot of women coming through the pipelines at the very beginning, early years of the career, and then slowly, slowly they disappear when you move towards more leadership role, but also when you move into fields. Journalists feel that they are not considered female. Like, think about business, sports, economics, politics. There are a lot of women out there writing and reporting on these topics, but they're still, like, the minority. So I think there have been changes. There is still a lot of work to do, especially, in providing the right tools then for these people, especially when we look at underrepresented group or marginalized communities, that they don't often have a voice on how to then progress further. Because, okay, we bring you in, there are mentoring programs, journalism courses and everything, but then what do you do after you reach a certain level of experience? Where do you go next? And this reflects as well in the news that we put out there. If we don't have diversity in the newsroom, even what we read on newspapers and watch on TV is quite the same, doesn't have any difference. So 2021 is the year that everything changed, right?
Yet again, yes, no, I've had several moments of reckoning, and 2021 was a time when I decided to give my journalistic career another kick and give it a bit of a rumble. So yes, at that point I'd been at the BBC for about 14 years, and the BBC, throughout history, every so often there are issues around redundancy, there are issues around restrictions, in terms of sort of tightening the newsrooms, in terms of staff. And at that point in time, I took a leap of faith, in a pandemic. I took a leap of faith in a pandemic that I needed to create some change in my life. And I think this is actually quite important for you to be aware of sort of the background to this, in that for a lot of that, so the year before I'd had the best job I'd ever had in my entire life. And I'm so grateful to the BBC for giving me that opportunity. I really fought for it. And I went to the North America Bureau and I was a social news writer. So it's pretty much like a correspondent role. And I broke records for the organization. And honestly, it was what the 8-year-old dreamed of in terms of reporting the best story that one can report on and really like working on life-changing stories. And then I came back and the pandemic happened. And one of the things that I was doing, I basically volunteered to be part of a very, very small team, of people that had experience working on traumatic stories, experience working on sensitive stories, because that is my background. And I was interviewing people whose relatives had died in the pandemic. So that would be a lot of my job. And I was sitting at home, I had my own personal circumstances. And the more I was listening to these, what now I guess you would call them obituaries, tributes, and not all of them made it onto air, not all of them even made it into the news sphere. So often you were just a listening person, because back then, a lot of people were very lonely. Bear in mind, there was a lot of forced isolation. People were dying and people weren't able to say goodbye. It really brought home to me about what did I want my life to be like, and what did I want my legacy to be like? And in often traditional legacy newsrooms, there can be challenges around progression when it comes to people like me, who are a little bit different. And I think I'd come to a point at the BBC where I really wasn't getting much further. And I really think I'm really, I am proud of everything I did in that organization. I'm so proud. I wrote a book. I changed people. I know I changed people's lives. I became a really, really good journalist. I came in as a trainee. I moved up and down, you know, in between senior roles. I had built up a really strong community, but it was time for me to figure out what I could do without being Dritisha, BBC journalist. I wanted to know what else I was. And the thing is, when you're in an institution, it's very easy to become institutionalized. And having done a lot of those stories, so they did have an effect on me. I felt that I needed to find a little bit more about my own identity. So that's what happened in 2021. The fact there was a cost of living crisis, would I've thought differently about it? I would have factored that in further, though, I think, because working as a freelancer is not necessarily easy. Again, it's about making connections. When I've applied for conventional roles, if I'm honest with you, I think the AI doesn't quite necessarily like me, bearing in mind that there are biases around it, and I have a name that's not well, it's a name with a lot of sort of racial connotations and a lot of heritage. But I've also managed to do some amazing things that I probably wouldn't have had the chance to do had I been in an artificial hierarchy in a big legacy organization.
What did you discover about yourself in this pivotal moment? What are the things that you done, the stories you wrote? I know there is also a podcast, so tell me more.
So clearly I have a lot of creative energy to burn. I have more friends than I thought I had. I actually thought at the end of it, because maybe this is the pandemic, I was a bit of a misanthrope. That was like, oh my God, people. And it's like, no, actually, I don't, I like people. I thought at one point I was like, maybe I don't like people. Like, because I'd done a lot of negative stories. That's the other thing, for like 10 years of my life. And I think this is again really, really important. I was doing a lot of traumatic stories. I was doing, you know, I was being exposed to some of the worst horrific stories that one could be exposed to, you know, with I was also doing a lot of social justice personally in terms of that element of trying to encourage more women, more people from ethnic minorities, more underrepresented groups to be in our industry. And unfortunately, by doing that, you do come across obstacles and you do get tired and you do get burnt out and you do come across people who just don't like you because you're different and you're trying to shake things up. And that can be quite hard, you know, to be like, oh my gosh, people really love me or they really don't like me. And I realized in this time, this pivotal moment, that I'm okay with that. But often, in order to be able to create change, and I do think I do try and create change, it means that you will be shifting other people's perceptions of what's right or what's traditional or what's conventional. And it can mean that it's quite lonely. And actually, I'm more at ease with the loneliness aspect of doing that. What I don't like as a freelance is the loneliness aspect because I like to collaborate with people. I like to bounce ideas. So hence that's where the podcast came about. It's called Have You Thought About? Because that's a lot of the questions that I would say to people when they'd be like, oh, Dree, oh, can we bring you on for this? Can we thought about, can we do some work on this? And I'm like, well, have you thought about doing this? Have you thought about doing that? So providing that very different perspective. And the reason the podcast, as I said, come about is because I wanted to also connect with people. In my life, in my career, I've come across some amazing characters, far more interesting people than I would ever hope to be. And it was a chance to actually amplify what they were doing, as well as connect back with them and say, like, hey, what are you up to now? You know, if you take, you know, one of the first people that's on the podcast, Rufelwe Ledwaba, she's like South Africa's first black female helicopter pilot. How amazing is that? And yet in the podcast, the thing that she talks about is how she's back in academia and how she uses the drag curve, which you learn about in aviation in her academic world, like how to keep ahead of problems. I'm using that now, right now in my life. I'm like, okay, what would Rufelwe do? So going back to that learning, it's about the fact that, you know, I like to try different things. I often think that you need to have this interdisciplinary approach in order to be a better storyteller. So right now I have a scholarship with an improv organization. So I'm doing improv and I'm working up to my first show. I've never done improv before in my life. I'm doing a lot more science writing. Again, I keep applying for things. Often I get rejections because that's just the way that life is. Other times, when I get an opportunity, I will really go for it. So, I was helping to judge at the Radio Academy Awards. So that wouldn't necessarily have happened in my previous lifetime because that was not within my sphere of things I could do, or I would perhaps be given permissions to do. What else am I doing? My book is still doing the rounds. It's a mashup of financial literacy and nature. I'm doing lots of really random different things, but when you look back at it, you see there's a big overlap in terms of its storytelling, its narrative. I'm coaching, I'm an accredited coach now. It's encouraging other people to take ownership of their ideas. And mentally, I'm a lot more happier than I was for quite a long time. I mean, talking about mental health, I'm still doing things around trauma awareness because I think it's really important that we have that awareness in our industry. And I really think there's a culture shift now happening. I'm teaming up with others to do mental health awareness. When I first started as a journalist, you didn't have trauma awareness, especially if you worked in the digital sphere. You didn't have those conversations around this is actually affecting my mental health, or I need to go and take some time out. Now, to be involved in those conversations is wonderful and amazing. So right now, I have lots of fingers in lots of pies. It would be brilliant to get paid better because honestly, in our industry in the UK, freelancing and journalism generally isn't paid as well as it should be, as well as it should be recognized for. But I'm far more content than I had been for quite a long time. I'm still doing journalism. I'm still writing for tier one, newspapers and publications, and being asked to do investigations. So it's nice to have that reputation. But let's see what happens next. I'm very open to doing things. It's fun. It's ridiculous, serious, ridiculous. So I'm embracing it.
I can see behind you, Beer Markets and Beyond. I know that's your first book, right?
Yes, it is. I love that people like you do, doing all this authoring. I haven't got another brilliant idea at the moment. The reason why I'll sort of show this book came about because there was a need. There was a need because I was feeling like an imposter. So I was doing a lot of traumatic stories when I was at the BBC, as I said. Again, I don't want to trigger people, but the nasty things one could imagine. And one of the things that you should be doing when you're doing such traumatic stories is that you do actually need to have some sort of respite. And so I moved to the BBC Business Unit. And I'd be in these meetings with all these people who knew what the heck they were talking about, had investment backgrounds. And I'm like, I'm just really good at telling stories or making boring things relatable. And I was having therapy at that point as well. And I started drawing. And from there, that's where the book came about, is because it literally was like, there's all these cool words in business about animals. So they're not words I've made up, they actually exist, like these allegories. And I couldn't find a dummies guide. That's literally what it came out of. The fact is, I looked for a dummies guide in business using nature, and I didn't find one. And I thought, well, let me create one. And I spoke to people, and in my free time, I'd be sketching. And managed to get an A to Z, put it in for the BBC's Creative Challenge. We got rejected. I managed to get an illustrator on board as well, who's a much better illustrator of animals than I am. It's always good to get someone, so you can focus on one thing while they focus on the other. But yeah, it's a question of not giving up. And I didn't give up with this book. So we still managed to get an A to Z out. It even got translated into Ukrainian. So, fair play to the Ukrainians. And then I was like, well, actually, we've got enough for a book. Oh my God, the journey to getting a book when you don't have an agent is a nightmare. But the thing is, I knew there was a need for it. I knew there was a demand for it. And so I had like 100 rejections. Literally, I would write to people, say, would you be interested in this? No, it's wonderful, but it's not for us. Would you be interested in this? Nothing. Hello, I've got this idea for a book. Look, we've created it. And the illustrator and I, Dominic, we end up creating a prototype and then doing things you're not really supposed to do. Pretending that we're really, really important, and got it in front of a publisher, and that's how we got a book deal. And off the back of that, it came out in the pandemic, and the book, honestly, I now use it as my business card. So I'll take it place and say, if you want to understand what I'm about, here is my weird, wonderful animal guide to the world of business. Here are some illustrations, and here is me telling some comedy, but verified. Everything's been double second sourced, verified anecdotes or verified going back to the dictionary. This is the first origins of the term lame duck, for example, which we've illustrated as a duck with a walking stick. This is what it is. And the book's won an award. You know, it's so David Attenborough wrote us a letter. It's in schools, it's in libraries, it's done everything I wanted it to do. But it came out in a pandemic, and I haven't had much support getting it out there. But I would hope me telling you this story now shows the sort of person that I am through the medium of getting this book out there as my sort of creative thing. But in terms of other ideas, I've had poetry published since, I've had short stories published since. But when people are like, what's your next book idea? I'm like, I don't know what the gap is until I realize what the gap is, that I'm like, I really can provide something different, something unusual, something that's really going to help people. I'm sort of a bit stuck, to be honest. Like, I'm just not at that stage. Sometimes I think about writing my memoirs, but some of it's like, you know, would people even believe half the stuff that's happened? It's so ridiculous. So, I don't know. This wasn't even the question that you're asking. This is unfortunately how I am. I'm like, look, I'm really proud of it because it's so ridiculous, but so important. And I know it's helping people understand business in a much better way. And you can mash up things that you don't think go together, like financial literacy and nature. You can do whatever you want to do as long as you've got substance to it. So I hope whoever is watching this, listening to this, is aware of that. Take my example of my ridiculous yet serious book as hopefully inspiration that you can also do something if you really, really believe in it.
True. This is the biggest takeaway. And don't even if you didn't answer to my own question, it's really interesting to know how all the idea of this book came out. And it's interesting. That's why by looking even just at the cover, you need to ask, what is this about? It's something that I never see before in my life. So definitely intrigued. I will read it and I will let you know what I think about it. We are almost at the end of this beautiful conversation. I will not like to stop, but I only have a couple of questions left. So, what is one thing that you will change about the media and the newsroom today?
There's a lot of things. If we're going to pinpoint it down, I would say that various newsrooms, various news organizations, various sort of media narratives are very, very good at spotlighting social injustice elsewhere. And I think sometimes people who, especially in senior leadership positions in those newsrooms, who are taking out those media narratives, need to be able to find time to take a step back and spotlight those concerns in their own newsrooms. So where you see issues around fair pay or inequity happening elsewhere in other institutions, in other industries, they're very much happening within the journalism industry. They need to be tackled in a much stronger manner.
I agree with this 100%. And if you could give one piece of advice to your younger self, what would it be?
Listen less to what other people think about you at a younger age, because you will always be slightly irritating to somebody. And it's not because of who you are, it's just because of their perception of what you represent. And I really wish I'd learned that at a much younger age, because it meant that I would take things less personally and I'd be able to progress my energies on my own stuff rather than worrying what, why so and so, you know, really didn't like the way that I did particular journalism when there was no substance to what they're saying. So I think that is a really important lesson for those of us who are a little bit different.
And what's the best advice that you received throughout your career, one that you still remember till now?
Think the best advice has always been, don't step on other people. At the end of the day, you don't know what positions people are going to be in or where they're going to be. And as a supplementary to that, it's just treat people with respect. And I think that is really, really important. You know, whatever story you're doing, however you're interacting with people, you know, it's about giving due respect. And that I think will get you quite far. And that's the advice that I, you know, have been given in various forms from some amazing people. And honestly, it stood me in very good stead throughout the years.
Well, this was a beautiful conclusion to this very, very interesting conversation. Thank you again very much, Druti, for sharing your experience, your knowledge, for inspiring us to, you know, try something ridiculous sometimes and follow our ideas. And I hope to see you again on When Power Podcast soon, and keep us posted with everything that is coming after.
Thank you so much for having me, Larry. I really, really appreciate it. And good luck with the podcast and all the other conversations. I shall look forward to hearing them.
Thank you.